Good evening. I'm Fiona Branton. I'm the president of the Harvard Law School Forum, and I'd like to welcome you all here tonight. Our guest tonight is national correspondent, or national affairs correspondent for CBS News. Before that, she was a White House correspondent since 1979. She's also the moderator for Face the Nation. Through her White House job, Ms. Stahl has covered many exciting stories having global impact, including the 1985 summit meeting between President Reagan and Gorbachev, the controversy over the administration's refusal to impose economic sanctions on South Africa, and the attempt on President Reagan's life in 1981. She has had a unique opportunity to follow many important news events from the White House perspective. And she's been involved in a lot of the presidential campaigns, including the one that's going on right now. She's a native of the Boston area, or at least she spent a lot of time in the Boston area, and she came out of Channel 5 here. We're very lucky to have with us tonight Ms. Leslie Stahl.
What an intimidating microphone. Can you hear me? I'll tell you a microphone story, true story. A newspaper man came to CBS about 20 years ago from the New York Times. And usually on the first day at CBS, it happened with me, a reporter is taught about the equipment, about the mics, the cameras, the lights, whatever. But this particular newspaper man came on a very busy news day, probably one like last Monday's Black Monday on Wall Street. And there was no time to teach him. They needed him to go up to the Hill and interview a senator. So he got up there, and the sound man handed him the mic, and he asked his question. And as the senator began to answer, he took the mic, put it under his arm, whipped out his notebook, and began to take notes. I'm going to try and talk right into this mic. Sticking out there. Anyway, we have had a lot of news in the last few weeks in Washington, Wall Street, Persian Gulf, Douglas Ginsburg. I'm really here to find out what you know about him. And arms control. It's been an exciting time for us who work there, and I thought I would first try to tell you a little bit about life for a television correspondent in Washington. I had covered the White House for 8 years, so my major perspective is from that building still, even though I don't work there anymore. So try to keep that in mind when I tell you that we do mainly three things. And the first is that we decode. You cannot imagine the language morass that a person in my position has to go through every single day, because there are on the record briefings all over town every day, every week, every work day. There's a briefing at noon at the State Department, there's one at the Pentagon, there's one at the White House, and when news gets hot, there's one at the Treasury and so forth. It goes on and on. And these spokesmen, these official spokesmen, are paid to manicure their phrases so that no one could possibly understand what they're talking about. My all-time favorite was Larry Speaks at the White House, when there was a story on the front page of the newspaper. It was clearly true, but he did not want to be on the record admitting that it was true and confirming the story. So he told us it was counterfactual. The word games get really confusing. You all know now that taxes are revenue enhancements. But if you are, for example, in favor of increasing the military budget, you will refer to it as defense spending, because defense has a very positive connotation. But if you happen to be against increased military budgets and so forth, you would refer to it as Pentagon spending. Because the Pentagon has a negative connotation. Now, here's my, this is, you're hearing it here first. You know, domestic spending is out. That's very bad. But a lot of people think we have to spend more on education, the infrastructure, but they don't want to call it domestic spending. And you're going to start hearing this word a lot, investments. investments in education, investments in road building, and so forth. So we have all these word games we go through. Another thing we reporters do, particularly television reporters, is stake out. Part of our jobs are to be like Cagney and Lacey. And I'm not kidding. When I covered the White House, I really draped myself on the lawn every day to see who went in, because of course they don't publish the president's schedule in its entirety. There are about three or four different schedules of the president's. There's the one that they give the press, and we will then know whom he's meeting that they want us to know about. Then there's sort of the second schedule of the president's that the staff has, and those are the people they want the staff to know about. And then there's a third and a fourth one that maybe even Nancy doesn't see the fourth one. Anyway, we do a lot of staking out in Washington, and it really became a true form, almost an art form of reporting during Watergate. That's when it really started. And it started because, as you can imagine, these officials didn't want to talk to us, the officials being Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, Dean, and so forth. So we would appear on their front lawns every morning at 6 o'clock so that we could ask them the question of the day, which, frankly, we read in the Washington Post. But the point is, really, that in that time, we would stake out even when we didn't have to. We got into the habit of showing up on people's lawns, even if we could call them on the telephone and make an appointment for an interview. And I bring that up because I want to tell you a story that's a true story of one day during Watergate. I was assigned to stake out Justice William Douglas, who was on the Supreme Court. And I thought, oh my God, what has he done? And they said, no, we need pictures of him jogging. So get out to his house tomorrow around 5 and just make sure you get pictures of him jogging. So I woke up at 4 and it was hailing out. And I heard the pellets on my window. And I called in and I said, you know, Justice Douglas is 70 years old and it's hailing out. And I was new then and young. And so the guy, of course, put me down and said, look, kid, everybody knows Justice Douglas is an outdoorsman. And even if he doesn't jog, he'll walk. He'll be out there with his dog. Just get out there. And so I did. And it was 7:30 and no lights on in his house. And 9:30, this giant limousine pulled up with Justice Blackmun in the back seat and a driver in the front seat. Justices carpool to work in a limousine. They drive up the lawn, up the driveway, and Mrs. Douglas carries him across the slippery driveway into the limo. Come down the driveway, and we're at the base of the hill, and we've got a Frezzy light and an umbrella, because it's still hailing, and the microphone, and he rolls down the electric window, and I said, hi, I'm Leslie Stahl. We've been here since 6 o'clock to get pictures of you jogging. Justice Douglas said to me, are you crazy? I am 70 years old, and it's hailing. Well, clearly I made my name during Watergate, there's no question about it. The secret of Watergate for me, and I did, I hit the scene and Watergate happened and it was my story. I was number 2 on the story. But really what happened in 1972 wasn't Watergate, it was the passage of the affirmative action laws. And CBS hired a lot of women in 72. And during Watergate, once the Senate hearings started, decided that I would be part of the live analysis roundtable discussion every night that went on at 11:30 at night. And there were these veterans around me who never let me talk. I would be introduced at the beginning of the segment, and we were there to explain to the public what that day's testimony had meant and what the significance of it was and what they should look for tomorrow and all of that. But they never let me talk. There'd be a moderator, John Hart. He was, he's now with NBC, he was with us. He'd introduce a segment, and then one person would make a statement, one of the guys, the veterans, and the other one would disagree, and they'd fight for 10 minutes, and that would be it. And you would hear me saying, I agree or I disagree, but that was it. So finally, the bosses said, look, it looks terrible. Let her talk. If she doesn't talk tonight, we're just going to have to cancel this whole segment. Because it really looks ridiculous. So everybody knew I was going to talk. The word was out. So for some incredibly impish reason, John Hart's opening question was, well, folks, what's the gossip about the FBI? Well, frankly, I heard the word gossip and thought I would wait for the next question. I mean, why does the girl have to do the gossip, right? But no, I'm sitting there with two guys, and they both turn in and look at me. But I'm holding ground, my ground, and I'm not going to gossip. So after what it was an interminable amount of dead air, which you know is deadly on television, Dan Shore said, live, don't forget, live primetime television, said, well, John, if it's gossip you want, that's why we have a woman here. Well, I could hardly stay in control. I had forgotten the point of the question. All I could remember was gossip. I'd lost the whole point. I yammered on and made no sense. And the show ended, and I ran upstairs, and I called home, and I said, Daddy, how do you write a letter of resignation? Clearly, I said something really clever, like they threw me the ball and I dropped it, or something like that. And my father said, no, don't be silly. You were great. God, you're smarter than they are, and what a firm voice. And by the way, you looked good, and like that. And I said, Daddy, if you are not going to level with me, put Mother on the phone. And my father said, Mother can't talk right now. She's too upset. Oh, we do have to pick ourselves up and march on. And I'll do that by telling you that the third thing that we Washington reporters, particularly at the White House, do is try to escape the noose of media management, which becomes extremely difficult when the president is popular, as Ronald Reagan has been up to now. I started covering the White House in 1977, and Jimmy Carter was president, and there were gas lines, and his poll ratings were sinking like the Titanic. If Reagan was Teflon, by that point in his presidency, Jimmy Carter was the flypaper president. Everything bad stuck to him, and stuck to him forever. If Billy made a deal with the Libyans, somehow Jimmy Carter got egg on his face. If the president swatted away at a killer rabbit, he was ridiculed, not for weeks, but for months. Months. The cartoonist just went on and on and on. And I don't know if you know this, but there was a story in the Boston Globe that was written about President Carter, and somebody, as a joke, wrote a headline over it, and the joke got into the first edition of the paper. The title of the joke story stuck on the president, and the title was More Mush from the Wimp. And from that day on, the word wimp was stuck to the president of the United States. Then along came Rambo Reagan. Bad news never penetrated his own personal SDI defense shield. See, he had this Star Wars shield that he walked around with, and the bad news bounced right off it. He knows what he's talking about. Anyway, his Teflon, I think, has now peeled. And I just want to plant this idea in your minds. I'm not going to go on and on about it, but it's very eerie because it looks as though the Ayatollah has brought down two American presidents. But let's explore for a moment not what has brought President Reagan to the point that he is at right now. But let's look at his long run of power, which he maintained in his hands for 6 years. He dominated the national agenda, despite what Congress wanted to deal with, despite what the press wanted to write about. The country focused for those 6 years almost exclusively on the subjects, the priorities, and the policies that Ronald Reagan wanted to deal with. What I really want to tell you is how impressed I am with how that power that he had flowed directly from public opinion, and how our democracy truly does function. The public liked him, and we'll get to why in a minute, but the public liked him. And therefore, elected officials And I speak mainly about Washington. In fact, I speak almost exclusively about Washington. Congressmen and senators didn't criticize Ronald Reagan because they knew their constituents had not given them the go-ahead. They did not have license from the people who sent them to Washington to pick on the president. The signals were, we like this man in the White House, lay off. Without that criticism, the press has no sources. There's no second day story. A reporter can do a story about the president, let's say, wanting to cut the budget for school lunch programs. And it goes out and it's a story. There's no second day story because there's no congressional committee that decides they have to hold hearings on this, and there's no news conference by disgruntled mothers or whatever. I mean, the story is a one day story. It has no influence, it has no legs, as they say. The opposite was true with Jimmy Carter. As his poll ratings went down, somehow the public signaled their people in Washington, their congressmen, let's say they were in a labor union, they signaled the union leaders, let's say you belong to some kind of lobby organization, they were notified by polls or letters or whatever. We don't like what this man's doing. You be our spokesman, tell the press. I sat in the White House and people would call me. I really didn't have to work that hard to hear criticism of the president. He was a Democrat. Democratic chairman of committees in the Senate and the House would tell me. They would invite me to come and put a camera on them so they could criticize him on camera. he got a bad press. Reagan got a good press because we didn't where it starts. Reagan's Teflon grew from his poll ratings. His popularity meant that when things didn't go right, he was forgiven. News conferences and he made mistakes didn't matter. The press reported it, but it didn't matter. Blunder scandals. I remember covering the Rita Lavelle EPA scandal, and I really thought that that was going to, the gloss would be off. I mean, we talk about Teflon, you know what I mean when I say the Teflon would have peeled, that the shine would be gone and his power diminished because he had this ugly scandal, and it did seem to linger, and it was a story that went on. And then one day, it totally vanished. It disappeared. Bitburg, that was it. I thought, okay, that's the end. His power is really going to be much less great now. Disappeared. Why was he popular? One reason, the economy, obviously. And perhaps the dominant reason was the economy. It seemed to be healthy. People felt that it was going in the right direction. That was the backbone of it. We had peace. Very important, obviously. And there's a third factor, and that's the president's image on television. And I would like to tell you a story. Because I wonder if you're going to have the same astonished reaction I did. In 1984, when the president was running against Mondale, I did one long piece on the campaign. Usually our pieces run a minute and a half, 90 seconds, that's your average piece for a campaign or a White House story or a story on the intricacies of our economic or foreign policy, 90 seconds. This piece ran a 5.5 minutes. And the point of it really was that what you saw was not what you got. The president was out, for example, campaigning at a nursing home, and he was cutting the ribbon on the new building, new nursing home in, it was some city in upper state New York. And you saw him do that, and I said, no hint here that he tried to cut the budget for nursing home construction. Then you saw him at the Handicapped Olympics. And I said, no hint here, those aren't the words I used, but the president tried to cut the budget for the handicapped. And it was a whole series of vignettes like that where you saw him doing some environmental event, and I would say, but he cut the budget, or he's trying to create amnesia over his policies that have become unpopular. It was a very tough piece. It was certainly the toughest piece I had done on Ronald Reagan up to that point. And I was very nervous about going back to the White House the next day. But the piece ran, and my phone rang that night. and it was a senior White House official, and he said, great piece. And I said, come on, did you hear what I said? I basically said that the president was lying to the American people. And he said, but look at all those great pictures you ran of Ronald Reagan. And I said, yeah, I know, but did you hear what I said? And he said, you guys haven't figured it out yet. You guys don't know that when the pictures are that strong and that positive, the public doesn't hear you. And I didn't know that. I was shocked, totally shocked. I hung up the phone and I called all the people at CBS who deal with campaigns and politics, and they were also shocked. So I started to tell this story the way I'm telling you. And a writer in Washington whose name is Martin Schramm, he was a reporter at the Washington Post at that time, heard my story. And he took my piece and brought it to a seminar, a group like this group at the Smithsonian in Washington. And he ran it without my sound. You didn't hear me. You just saw the 5.5 minutes go by of Reagan in front of flags, balloons, kids with flags. He has a great walk, you have to admit, he has a great walk. And his sound, if he said anything, then you heard him, but you never heard what I was saying. And then they were asked to tell what they thought that was. And that, they all said, was a paid campaign ad for the Reagan campaign. And then he ran it again with my voice. And a huge percentage said, oh, that's what we said, it's a campaign ad. In other words, he showed that what the White House had told me was true, that the picture was so dominant that if it conflicts with the sound, it overrides the sound. The sound is irrelevant if it conflicts. And Marty Schramm wrote a book about it. And in the book, he says something I didn't even know, and that is that Michael Deaver, for this entire campaign, would go out to where the president was going to speak and place the president and then place the camera platform so that he knew exactly what pictures we would be getting at every single location. And of course, the Secret Service would not allow the reporters or the cameras to be anywhere but the designated positions. So we would arrive in a town ahead of the president, this always happens anyway, and the cameras were in their designated positions, forced to go and stand there, and there are no other pictures of that anybody who traveled with the traveling Reagan campaign or traveling White House press corps of anything other than what Michael Deaver established, which was in effect a Hollywood set. So even if I had wanted to use pictures from the campaign that weren't gorgeous, I didn't have any. Anyway, at CBS, we have only talked a little bit about this. This was 84, we're already into 88. No thought, really, no decisions have been made as to whether we change the way we report this campaign. No real discussion if we should change the way we report this campaign. I mean, you can't really go out and censor pictures of the president just because he looks good. That doesn't make any sense. And there has been this steady march away from the talking heads on television. They're considered boring. So you just can't have any more, anyway, a reporter standing in front of a camera and just saying, here's what it means. We don't do that. Maybe we should get back to it. I also got to thinking very recently that this effect of the visual dominating the verbal has a reverse side to it. And I began to think about it during the Bork hearings, when you saw in some polls that some people didn't like the way he looked and didn't like his beard, didn't like his manner. And I began to think that perhaps the negative, the visual that's negative, can also be a dominant image and have an effect on the public's mind just as much as a positive. In other words, a reporter can do a report and be quite positive. I know that's hard for you to believe, but just try to pretend it's possible. And if the picture or the person she's doing the report on is unattractive or unappealing, you could have the opposite effect. What do you do about it? I don't know. I wonder, and I've been thinking about this since Black Monday, if the public was basically content and happy during the first 6 years of Reagan's presidency because of the economy and because of peace and because people thought he was doing a good job with the Russians. And if you have no sense of crisis, if you can lean back and let the pictures come at you, but if you feel threatened by the stock market or the Persian Gulf or whatever, that you might suddenly have your senses piqued, that if you feel threatened, maybe you hear harder, maybe you pay attention more, maybe the words count. And I'm wondering if something natural might not happen as people worry about the economy. Maybe people are going to want to hear the words. And it's possible that it was a natural thing that we went with the pictures. And that everything, even in the way we reported, flowed from public opinion. And that maybe we'll begin to sense that the public wants to hear the thoughts and the ideas and the solutions. And we really will begin putting people, talking heads on, to just talk. And maybe these debates with these officials will begin to be more issue-oriented, as there are serious problems to be solved. It's kind of an optimist view, but it really is possible in my own mind. I wanted to tell you one more thing before I take your questions, and that is that I went to the Soviet Union 2 weeks ago. I went in with a group of American officials. I was there as an observer, and it basically was off the record from my perspective. But something happened that I just want to pass on to you, and that is how impressed I was with how much they're thinking. It's unclear that Glasnost is going to work. We saw officials argue in front of us about what they were going to do with information. I think they're confused too as to where it's heading and whether it's right and whether it'll succeed. But one man told our group the following. He said, "We are going to deprive you, Americans, of our enemy image." And the fact that we have that enemy image in your mind establishes your own self-image. It is the basis for all your alliances. It accounts for, and he used this very word, it accounts for your state of mellowness, he said. If we are the evil empire, why, you must be the empire of good. And then he said, "We're going to succeed, and you won't know who you are." And I was dazzled by that. I thought that was really smart. And I worried that we're not thinking as hard. They're still our adversary wherever they, whatever direction perestroika and glasnost takes them, even though I think they have tacitly admitted that their system doesn't work. But what I realized was they've given up ideology. They're total pragmatists. Even if this process of resistance to Gorbachev's reforms is being played out for our eyes, it is not a fight over ideology or religion, the religion of communism. It's turf battles. It's good old political turf fights. And there's no ideology left. They're just hard-nosed, cold, hard-thinking pragmatists. And I'm waiting for the American people, and I think it will come, to start demanding that in our public officials, and wanting to hear it and wanting to know that we're thinking too. Anyway, I want to come back to my overall theme, that reporting flows from public opinion, that the way our officials are flows from public opinion, that Ronald Reagan was so popular meant that he could say, "I'm not going to hold news conferences." And the press could scream and yell and say, "Well, you have to, that's part of what a president does." And he could say, "But I'm not going to." And that was it. There was no outcry from anybody. That was fine with everybody. You know, I kind of have a feeling the public's going to want to hear from him, and somehow it's going to begin to change. But it has to start with the American people. Even the way the press reports is influenced by the American public opinion. And I suppose we can all take a great deal of heart in that, because it is democracy, and it truly functions in our country, and that's very positive. And I just hope public opinion moves in a direction that's ripe for the future. Anyway, those are my prepared remarks. So tell me about Douglas Ginsburg. Are you going to come up and ask me questions, or are you just going to respond to what I said, or take us off in a different direction?
I have a question about CBS and the cutbacks. How have these cutbacks affected your ability to report and your ability to report the upcoming campaign, and specifically your ability to report?
Well, first let me say that something wonderful has begun to happen, and that is CBS is going to have two, CBS News, as opposed to the network, is going to have two new shows on the air. We're going to now have the morning news back again. We only had a half hour. We're now going to do 2 hours. And we're going to do a new weekly, I don't know if they're calling it a documentary, but another hour news show in prime time called 48 Hours. So a lot of people are being hired back. So we're in a funny moment in time in terms of the cutbacks. A lot of the people who were let go were a certain echelon of the young person who comes into the business and wants to prove himself. They're not quite junior reporters. They call them producers, junior producers. And they're people who are very smart, and if I'm working on a story and need an interview done, and I can't go do it because I now have to write my piece, it's 5 o'clock, I want to send you out to go do it for me. You're really bright, you go and do it. I get a good interview. You're trying to prove yourself, you're helping me, and you're learning to be a reporter. Well, we've lost that sort of echelon of person that we've always had at CBS. When I came there, even as a junior reporter, I was basically an apprentice to Dan Shore. I said I covered Watergate, but I was really number two, and my main job was radio. And I was learning, and I was trying to prove myself to him and to my bosses. And we've lost that, and that's depth. That's what it is. And we feel it. Yes?
Yeah. Even before the cutbacks, it seemed like the emphasis on foreign news coverage at CBS has gone down since the days of Walter Cronkite. I did my senior thesis on CBS News, and I charted this, and where news, foreign news would be often section one, sometimes it would be section three, more natural disasters would be moved up, and there would be a lot less hard news.
And you mean now?
Yeah, in the last 5 years.
Yeah. I'll talk to you about that.
I want to know what future is there. Is this 48 hours going to be able to do hard news, do something like what Nightline, I think, successfully does?
Well, it won't be like Nightline. There was
I just wanted to end the question, and that is, also I noticed in news coverage, as there used to be, that you'd have 10 seconds, maybe you'd call that a talking head, of, you know, getting a clip, a soundbite, quote, and now it's like 4 seconds, 5 seconds. It just seems that they kind of underestimate the intelligence or the attention span of the American people, that they can't hold people's thoughts for more than 4 or 5 seconds. And that just concerns me.
There were several years recently when there was a softening of the news. You certainly read about the change of power when Larry Tisch took over, and that was part of it. The news division erupted and sort of leaked stories and let it be known that those of us who were working there and had been working there for several years were very unhappy with the direction of it. And I think we once did a piece on a five-legged sheep or, you know, something like that. And we were all very, very, very unhappy. My sense is we've hardened up quite a bit, and we're doing much more serious journalism than we were, say, for this happened about a year and a half ago or more. So I think what you detected, we all felt very deeply, and it was a very painful period. The sound bites getting short. They're not 4 seconds, but they are short. And this is another problem. And we are constantly trying to expand them. You know, it's the age-old reporting dilemma. There's a show of 24 minutes. The average piece is really 90 seconds. I wasn't kidding. And I happen to agree with you that the sound bites are too short. And we've talked about that. A lot of people think they're too short. It's better to have two sound bites and have them run than four. And we really are trying to get back to that. It's a problem. What was your third point? Nightline. The new show will not be like Nightline because I don't think it's going to be a live situation on a set and interviews at all. I don't think they've fully worked out exactly how it'll be, but it will be on tape. And I don't think any of it's going to be live, I think. But don't hold me to that. But it won't be anything like Nightline. It will be exploring the big issue of that period. And it might not be the issue of that week. It might be the issue of the week before. But it will take one issue and explore it totally in depth, but on tape. Yes?
Before I ask my question, what's a sound bite?
I have to start out. A sound bite is when I interview you. Let's say I interview you for 30 minutes, and then we find your best 15 seconds, or maybe 12, and that's a sound bite. I'm sorry.
Recently, I've noticed on the CBS evening news that Dan Rather has taken to interview reporters at his side. I didn't notice it before, and I'm not quite sure what it's all about.
Well, it started during the Iran-Contra hearings when he came to Washington. And he had a little booth that they built up near the Capitol. And it sort of started because we were all in the same city. And why don't you just go instead of doing your little stand-up ender for your piece in front of the White House, just go do it right in our little studio that we built. And they liked it. And so they're continuing it. There's nothing more than that.
What are your thoughts about why the Soviets changed their mind about the summit and then changed again? What does it all mean?
Honestly, when I was there, there is such a sense of confusion within their hierarchy. I'll tell you a little anecdote. I know you're here reporting, and what I saw over there was off the record, so I do have to be careful. But one person from our group asked the Soviets to do more publishing or being more open in the sense of glasnost about their military spending. And one of the Soviet officials in the room said, yes, we're going to be. And a general from the other side of the room said, no, we're not. And this went on before us, and their translators translated it for us. We were there the same week that this Central Committee met, and this whole controversy that's been basically in the New York Times this week, where two top men around Gorbachev had the same kind of argument about the pace of reforms at the Central Committee meeting. I think that there's turf battles, there's uncertainty in their minds about I would think if they were watching our stock market last Monday, they'd all be rethinking, you know, because they've been moving toward capitalism.
Well, that's what I wondered. I wondered if it had anything to do. It was right after we had Blue Monday or Black Monday, and I wondered if they saw it as an opportunity to take advantage of President Reagan's popularity to say, no, we're not going to meet in, and thinking perhaps that would damage him even more.
Well, that was a question that was asked at the time, but now the reporters writing from Moscow are suggesting that it was much more Gorbachev's own personal political problems because there was a fight in the Central Committee and that he became uncertain about his own political power at that point and just sort of backed off for the moment instead of the idea that let's take advantage of the American president who's in a bad spot right now. He certainly turned around fast enough, didn't he? Incredible.
I have a question about covering presidential campaigns. Stuff's been written about horse race versus issues and boys in the bus, pack journalism. But when you're actually out there, what are you thinking? I mean, what are you looking at? What are you doing?
You're looking at making your deadline.
Is that the
getting
campaign?
The piece done before the evening? Well, I don't know if every reporter is the way I am. So I'm not speaking for every man. I'm speaking for me. I like to really say something, and I think you know, what is the theme of this little piece tonight? It doesn't always work that way. Sometimes the president speaks on four different subjects, or any candidate, and he does a little, makes a little news on the economy, and a little news on defense, and a little news on the Russians, and you end up stringing these together in a piece that doesn't hold together, really. And there's a lot of reporting like that, not just on campaigns, but just covering the president, where you basically just sew a bunch of events or sound bites together and try to make some sense of them. But on a day when it's going the way you want it to, you want to say, well, the president has been talking a lot about production. You know, we've got to get production up. And you actually do a piece that carries through with your opening sentence. There's a lead, and then you tell the story. You also have to do a lot of talking to officials. And campaigns are particularly difficult because you're traveling. It's much easier to be on a phone and get on the phone, get a guy in his office, and you talk. A campaign, you have a deadline. You have to break off at 4:30 or 5 o'clock in terms of television. And these people whom you want to talk to, the campaign manager, the press secretary, whatever, they're also traveling. And the added difficulty of reaching people for actual information instead of these pretty pictures becomes a challenge.
Do you start with an idea of what you've heard, though, or do you have to go video first, story later?
Well, it depends on that day. I love it when I can start with my idea first. And then you run into the problem of the message conflicting with the pictures. And I haven't in my own mind figured out how you escape that. If every picture of the candidate is before an American flag with balloons and waving kids, and you're trying to say something serious, maybe not critical, maybe not negative, but serious, is the public going to hear it? If these pictures, I mean, the message will be, oh God, look at him, he looks great, and everybody adores him. That's going to be what everybody really gets out of the piece. And there you are, trying to talk about the president says we have to have more production in this country. How do you do those two together? I don't know.
I'm a little bit confused. You seem to be reassured about the workings of democracy vis-a-vis when the president is popular, it's harder for the news media make critical stories can stick. Yet in some ways, isn't democracy having the public have full information? And this kind of Teflon-type approach, doesn't this result in a worse form of government?
The information gets out. I could ask you in this room, how many people think the president works hard? How many people think that the president's policy... I mean, I could ask you a series of questions about Ronald Reagan, and I'll bet you'd all have negative responses. And then you'd probably all voted for him. I mean, I don't know how many of you voted, but I mean, I can go to an audience. I can go to an audience of people, and I can ask those questions to prove that the information got out.
It comes from the press.
Well, no, the negative information is out.
I mean, all our information comes from the press.
That's right, and you like him.
We're not the source. We have no opinions other than what
you
the
do.
Press
you is. Like him. The press's stories have been basically to tell you that he doesn't work hard and here are his policies and all of that, and the public likes him. I'm saying we told the stories, and the public likes him, and that flows back so that that if you have a policy like Reaganomics, and you don't have a whole lot of people standing up in line to criticize it, the press isn't going to do a story on it night after night after night. The information is out there, and the public likes it. That's my point. We told all the stories, every one of them. They didn't take on a negative tinge because there weren't critics, and we didn't bang away at them because there weren't news conferences and hearings the way there were when Carter was president.
Don't you, the press tends to color the way the story is from what you perceive the audience. When you say that we like him, don't you color your story from what you think we like?
No. But I won't do a second day story unless I have a source.
During the course of his presidential campaign, two candidates have already withdrawn the nominations in the face of mounting pressure, first from the press and then from the public, on issues of questionable significance.
Now, you can argue about whether Gary Hart's marital fidelity and Joe Biden's possible performance are really crucial issues, but neither of these men were, you know, taking bribes or violating federal law while in office. Do you think that the press has gone overboard in trying to push these glamour issues in the public eye to the detriment of substantive issues? And let me personalize this by saying that in your interview 2 weeks ago on Face the Nation and Mary Cuomo, you repeatedly questioned him about these alleged ties to organized crime that his family had. And
I didn't do that.
After he denied it, you even basically tried to go through his family genealogy and have him deny on a name-by-name basis that every member of his family had no such ties. Again, I'll repeat my question. Do you think the press is going for the sexy issues to the detriment of substance?
Well, what's really interesting is I never said anything about organized crime in the whole interview. I want to talk about Mario Cuomo, but I don't think that the issues that forced Gary Hart and Joe Biden out of the race were questionable. Gary Hart went to, well, I don't even know what the name of that place is. He went to Bimini or whatever. In the middle of his campaign, when questions about that kind of behavior were floating around about him, why was he doing that? That's kind of weird behavior. I think it was reckless, and I think it wasn't about womanizing. It was about judgment. And I didn't cover that story. I read it the way you did, and I watched it the way you did. And I just think that it was all about his character and the kind of president he would have been. Joe Biden had a different problem, and it stemmed from the fact that he had a very negative set of stories come out about him before he had a lot of support. And he himself has said this, and I tend to agree with it. If you are basically unknown, and you have a real hit like that, that's all the public knows about you. If you're Ronald Reagan and you have a solid base of support, I mean, you can be criticized up and down the lot, and it bounces off, or you take a little plunge and you're cushioned back up. Joe Biden was almost the last one in the field, and he had no support to cushion him back up from it. And you know, it's a little funny, in my opinion, to blame the press for things that the press reports to the public that they don't like. That's our job. It's our job to explore character issues. It's our job to, particularly when they're already an issue about a candidate. I'm not so sure it's always appropriate to ask everybody in the race if they've ever had an affair or anything like that. But if there's something floating around about someone, I think it's appropriate to ask. I sometimes worry, not that we're too tough, but that we're not tough enough, that we don't ask all the questions. I agonize over the fact that maybe even though we didn't have sources over the last few years, we should have done stories anyway. So I would say that if you wanted to attack me in terms of the press not being tough enough, I'd have a harder time defending Mario Cuomo. I did ask Mario Cuomo if there were any skeletons in his closet. And I asked him the question over and over. I asked him because everywhere I go, and including our dinner tonight with representatives from your group, I was told that he's not running, probably because there's something in his background. And before I did the interview, I was told by another reporter who knows him very well that he's very upset about the rumors. And I, frankly, was also told by this reporter that there is nothing to the rumors. And that he would probably appreciate the opportunity to respond. So I did ask him. And I asked him repeatedly, because I thought he wanted to have the opportunity to get it out and confront it and deal with it, because they were whisper rumors. But it is true that wherever I've gone, people have two explanations for why he isn't in the race. I mean, cab drivers, reporters, public officials, unpublic officials believe two things about Mario Cuomo. Either that he's got some game plan that he's going to stay out and come in late, or that he's got a skeleton in his closet. But it's interesting, I never said anything about the mob or about organized crime. I mean, you must have somehow heard that. I never said it.
It seemed enough.
But that's his, you know, that's what enrages him, that people think just because he's Italian. And I frankly, honestly did it to get it out and let him express being, you know, his rage with it. And he didn't. He didn't express his rage with it. So it was all interesting. And then he called the New York Times after the interview and said, I have to deal with these rumors.
I'd like to return to the question of death. But before I do, the third possibility regarding Cuomo could be is because he wants to be a Supreme Court justice.
You know what? We asked him that after the interview. Someone in our group said, would you like to be a judge? And he said, that's always interested me.
I grew up watching CBS News, and when I did, there was this, let's say, quote-unquote, lengthy analysis, whether it be by Eric Severide or Bill Moyers, or for a brief time by Jeff Greenfield. If you're looking for analysis or in-depth commentary, in return to that question of depth, I think one can best find it in McNeil Lehrer, All Things Considered. My question is this: is depth reserved for 48 hours and 60 minutes in those evening specials?
Face the Nation.
Face the Nation. Or is CBS ever planning on returning to that depth in the evening news? You can always get it at Meet the Press and Big Breakley, and I mean, there are times I think the Lachlan Group is more in depth than CBS, NBC, and ABC Evening News.
Well, you know, it's the age-old problem. I've been in discussions with people at CBS saying we have to do that. I mean, people in power. We have to be more analytical. We have to get back there. I just read a piece on the plane yesterday saying they're still wooing Moyers to come back. So I think there's a sense that we've lost something. And I can't answer your question specifically because I'm not in management, but I think what you feel is missing, a lot of people at CBS feel is missing too, but it's not there right now.
If I could briefly follow up, I just want to say when we talk about whether, you know, what side of the story of the news, that analysis provides the viewer to make his or her own judgment about whether, in fact, an issue has been covered. When we talk about whether, you know, Mondale got a fair deal or rape didn't, that kind of analysis helps.
Well, I think I'm more on your side. I think you're right, and but it has to be the right person. I think the feeling that we should try to find the right person is there, but they haven't. Yes.
Could you address the way the media has covered the religious right or not covered it, not counting Jim and Tammy and all that sort of stuff, and to what extent or to what any kind of numbers? Born again Christians in the media, working reporters and that sort of thing.
Fred Barnes is a born again. I people don't go around and say what's your religion in the press. What do you mean by you mean how we cover it or?
They've had an incredible amount of influence over this administration.
Right.
And virtually nothing has been reported in depth about how deep their influence goes in the administration and how individuals, for example, like the Attorney General, utilize their Christianity or whatever.
Do you really think we don't report that? How do we all know it if we're not getting it from the press? We do know it. I mean, everybody understands.
No, I think what I'm getting at here is the depth to which that philosophy is being molded between group of people that are in the government, be they mid-level folks or top administrators, and why we never hear anything about it, we always hear about it. We always call it pro-life, for example. Never choice. It depends, the analogy you made earlier, depends on who you're talking to, whether it's an abortion is pro-choice or pro-life individual, and that sort of thing. And the whole spectrum of how the religious right has is active in this administration more so than any other. And I've just not seen any kind of in-depth reporting about those stories.
Well, as I listen to you talking about the influence and importance of the religious right in the Reagan administration, what I keep remembering is the old phrase you hear around any news organization like ours, oh, we've done that story already. And I think when Reagan was first president, we did a lot on that. And then you say, well, let's not revisit it. That's last year's story. It's old. And that happens a lot. There are people who think we should do stories over and over and over, and those people never win the battles. My sense is that the influence of the religious right is very well known, and as you point out, a lot of people at middle level government echelon have been placed there with a litmus test for their views on political issues. I have a feeling that not only did we do the story in the early phases of the Reagan administration, but a lot of print pieces were done on it. Perhaps it's time to revisit it, but I have a feeling that the focus of the press is going to be on these candidates right now. And so you're probably not going to see too much about it unless that element really becomes so influential in the political campaign that we start to talk about those people in terms of how they're affecting and influencing the campaigns out there.
They have had such an impact. Jerry Falwell's
That's right.
March into the White House.
That's right.
And you have to get it out of the fall levels, you don't get it out of the press.
But you do get it out of the press. You do. You don't understand how you know it. You know it because the press has told you.
Fall levels.
Well, and the press has told you too. I mean, do you watch Falwell's television show or do you watch him being interviewed? What?
Not deliberately.
Not deliberately. Okay.
Have you ever felt a specific backlash from one of your corporate sponsors about a story you've done?
Never. Absolutely never. Have I ever felt any kind of pressure or backlash from any corporate sponsor because of any story I've ever done? I never have. Women in broadcast journalism. Well, I've gotten myself in a little bit of trouble on this subject. So let me preface by saying that I am speaking only about CBS News because it is the only organization I truly know. And I don't think that the success that women have had at CBS is mirrored in other news organizations. My friends at ABC and NBC are not as happy with their organizations as the women at CBS. But the women at CBS have done pretty well. I covered the White House for 8 years, and that's a pretty good beat. And there's a woman covering the Justice Department, and the number two woman at CBS, the number two executive at CBS News is a woman. And the head producer of the evening news in Washington, which is one of the top producing jobs in the company, is a woman. And it goes on and on like that. There are women cameramen, there are women directors, and it's you never really know for sure how women have affected the way we cover news, but it's interesting to speculate. Several years ago, maybe back in 1972, 3, 4, something like that, the producer of the evening news called me on the telephone. And he said, well, we've got a story here about how there are too many hysterectomies being, too many operations. And doctors think that maybe they are doing too many and they're kind of knee-jerk suggesting these operations and they shouldn't be doing them. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, do you think we should lead the show with it? And I said, well, yeah, it's a pretty good story. He said, yeah, but we've never led the show with a health story before, and we've never led the show with certainly a story about women. What do you think? And I said, well, I think, you know, and he was, what he was doing was he was building support in an organization to put a story on that we would lead with like that today. If that were a big medical story, we wouldn't think twice about it. And this man was calling for some kind of support in the organization. I really think that we've had an influence not only in the way we operate in the environment, but in what we cover, I think. Well, it's certainly been easier since affirmative action. There's no question about it. And there's a critical mass of women. I don't know if it's 50-50, but it's getting there. I just think it's probably true in all fields, including law, at this point. But I tell you, I've gotten myself in hot water by being such an optimist on this subject, so better stop before I get in trouble again.
As a follow-up to the Gary Hart question, do you believe there's anything that should be off-limits to the press in the presidential campaign?
Well, I'm offended a little bit by the sex question. And I think it has to sort of fold into something that's out there about the candidate. I feel uncomfortable with that issue. But I don't think that was a central issue with Gary Hart. I think it was the idea that he would go off to a place like this with a woman in the middle of a campaign. And as I understand the Miami Herald situation, they had a source who kept calling the paper and saying, I know that Gary Hart is seeing this woman, I know it, why won't you go do the story? And they practically were dragged into it by this woman who kept calling and saying that she was outraged, that she knew about it, and she couldn't believe he was being so open and flaunting it, and basically embarrassed them into taking that plane to Washington to check out the story. There's a built-in reluctance to pursue the sex story. I do think that's personal and private. However, I'm sort of now going to ask the simple question of the candidates if there's any skeleton in their closet and see what the answer is that I get back. But, and that covers a multitude of issues when you ask it that way.
Are there other things besides sexual histories that you can think of that?
Well, maybe some medical issues, past illnesses and stuff like that. I know the New York Times sent out a questionnaire that kind of took my breath away about FBI reports and medical reports and have you ever seen a psychiatrist, and I don't know. You know, you wonder not only whether some of the questions that are asked of candidates have anything to do with governing and being president, but you also wonder whether the process in Iowa and New Hampshire has much to do with what it takes to be a good president. And I mean, the system all the way around needs to be changed, in my opinion. And I think maybe the press should sit down and have more seminars and talk about what's appropriate in terms of questioning. I don't know. Character is an issue, though. You get confused. Character is definitely an issue. And as someone said to me fairly recently, the issues that you discuss in a campaign in 1988 just probably, most likely, will not be the issue the guy confronts in 1990. So let's say we deal with the economy in this campaign. What are you going to do about the deficit? What are you going to do about interest rates and all of that? And then, you know, I don't know, let's say Brazil becomes something non-economic. I'm trying to think of some other issue that we never dealt with. It never came up. They never talked about. I mean, character has to be part of this. And the question, even when I say to you medical questions, I mean, maybe that is part of it. You want to know he's got, a stable way of dealing with issues in his mind. It's very difficult. Well, I tell you, that's what they tell us when we call in. Well, I want you to read this Marty Schramm book. It's called Videos in the title.
Great.
Yeah, okay. He makes that argument, and I will tell you that was one of the biggest fights we had during the 84 campaign. And I'll make a confession to you. When you're covering a candidate, you get proprietary, or you get competitive about getting on the air. And I would say, what do you mean we don't cover him? What do you mean we don't put him on the air? He's the president. He's campaigning. The American people have to see him out there. And there was a producer at CBS who was in charge of political coverage who said what you just said. And that tension went on through the campaign with us out in the field saying, well, but, you know, you have to show him. The public has a right to see. And I want to think again about it. I was probably wrong. And you're probably right, you know, now that I understand it a little better.
But you said yourself, you said this is the general perception 4 years ago. Nothing has changed.
Nothing has changed. Well, I mean, this is what happens all the time. I have had the discussion about we should be more analytical and more in-depth over and over and over. I have brought my campaign story around and around. I talk about it inside, and they say, yeah, we got to do something about that. And but let's cover this today's stories first. Yes?
I've always had a fascination with this event we call the Presidential News Conference. When a guy doesn't face the American public from March to October, and you're sitting in a room with fellow reporters when you were as a White House correspondent, do you get together and plan who's going to ask? I mean, there's so much that I wanted the press to ask Reagan the other night, and I felt so frustrated by the idea that his people were staging it somehow, or that you weren't able to get everything out. I wondered how much strategy goes on in those things.
I'll tell you something very interesting about the National Press Corps and the White House Press Corps, and that is an absolute fear that we'll be charged with collusion. Even when it comes to protesting an official who comes before you as a body and says, this is on background or this is off the record, you don't want to get together and plan to walk out on him. For some reason, there's this great fear that the public will come to see us as a pack, even though the public already sees us as a pack. We never get together in anything, ever. There's not even two of us that get in a corner to plan, except perhaps within our own group. CBS gets three seats in there. And usually he only calls on the front row, but if the second, you know, the radio reporter gets called on, for instance, you might plan it, but that's it. Everybody goes in with their own little question. And I always did try to follow up, but most people don't. Most people write down the question they want to ask, and it doesn't matter what has happened before he calls on you. You're going to ask your question no matter what. And although I didn't think this one was too bad from the reporter's perspective. I thought the big story was his change on taxes and Gorbachev, and most of the questions were dealing with that. So this one wasn't too bad, but I know what you mean.
I mean, you really do have that sympathy with the reporter. I mean, nailing him down. I mean, it's one of our few opportunities in the public to have presidential accountability. It seems to us spontaneous. It seems like the reporter's putting the president on the line.
Well, it is.
And you always root for them to keep pushing. He kept saying, I'm not going to talk about the negotiations.
Yeah.
And it seems a very powerful event. And I don't know whether I want the press to take more charge of it or how much charge they can take of the event.
Richard Darman, who used to be a number two to Jim Baker in the first term, told me once that they guess about 99% of the questions and they get them ready. And he almost is never surprised, almost never.
That's scary.
But you know what I found with Reagan, and I find this on Face the Nation too, and that is that somebody is prepared for a question and a follow-up, but they're not prepared for the third and fourth and fifth, and that's why I like follow-up questions. And Reagan is a master at not answering questions, a total master, an absolute genius at it. He really is. I mean, sometimes when public officials don't want to answer questions, it's very obvious. Because they just right away say something like, that's not the question, the question is, and they're off. But Reagan really starts to answer. And within some place between the first and second sentence, he's taken you off, and you can't quite figure out how it happened. And he's pretty good at it. Yes?
Follow up on his question. In Tran's book, there was some talk about the meeting of CBS people after the election, and you talked about what happened.
Oh, this is an election way back. We haven't done that in years.
I was going to ask if you had not asked if you had done that again.
No. But you know what? I read my observations, and I'd totally forgotten. That was so many years ago. And I kept saying, I couldn't believe they manipulated everything. And this was a sort of retrospective on the campaign, and CBS got all the reporters who had covered the 76 campaign in a room, and we were swapping experiences, and it was my first presidential campaign. And I sounded so naive. God, they manipulated everything. I couldn't believe it. Well, mainly because they would leak something to me. And I would think that there was this guy who'd gone off on his own and was being nice to me and giving me a story. And back at the ranch, they're going, God, we gave Stahl a story. She'll get it on the evening news. I was so naive.
Did you get guidelines? Or you just sort of told it sweeps, get good pictures? I mean, are there guidelines you sent out into the campaign with?
Are there guidelines?
I mean, sort of as to what the network is looking for coverage-wise?
No, it's basically up to you. But there's a general standard. There's a general sense that you go out in the morning and let's say you just turn the camera on and cover everything till about noon or two. Then you call in to the office in New York or in Washington and you discuss what you have and how it might form itself into a piece. And they tell you what's happened in other campaigns or in Moscow or in Wall Street. And from that point on, you keep calling in until the piece forms in everybody's mind, then you go write it. Yes?
Yeah. In your opinion, is there a relationship between good ratings and good news? And if not, doesn't that suggest some serious problems?
If there is not a relationship? Did you ask me if there was a relationship or if I think there should be a relationship between ratings and news?
In your opinion, is there a relationship between ratings and good news?
And good news? You mean upbeat news? No, but I think there's a relationship, unfortunately, between what the public wants and what we give them. And if you are in a period of complacency, with the public, I think what you begin to see on television lightens up, and that's what we've just been through. I think if public opinion, if the public is worried and threatened, the news will harden up. I'm so impressed with this. It's that it all does flow from out there, even if it's unintentional. And sometimes it's intentional, unfortunately. And I think that was a concern that those of us who worked at CBS had about how the news was becoming soft because people were looking at polls and they realized that's what the public wanted. But I think even if there weren't polls, it would happen to some extent anyway, unfortunately or fortunately. I don't know. I can't decide whether it's good or bad. I'm impressed with the fact that democracy works, and I get frustrated when I know that there's a tough, hard story to do and it doesn't get done. So, yes.
Yes, you said that one of the jobs of the person in the press is to decode what different people that you're covering might be saying. Who is, in your opinion, the worst offender and who is the best model in terms of...
Of press, of spokesmen?
Of openness of the press and...
Well, let me talk about the difference between the Carter and Reagan White House in that respect. Everything, it strikes me, in a White House or an administration reflects the man at the top, and I mean everything. So that when Carter was president, we had really complete briefings. We had briefings full of rich detail. I mean, what you would expect from a president who liked to read and liked to know every little tiny element of the policy and what went into making the decision. And the briefers were just the way he was. They'd come out, and we'd have 2 hours. I mean, your hand, you'd beg them to stop. Really. Please, I have a headache. I once flew home from a trip that Carter took. It may have been the summit in Geneva. And they briefed us. I was the pool reporter on Air Force One. And they briefed us for the whole trip. It was 9 or 10 hours. One after the next, they came up. And then, you know, as a pool reporter, you have to write a pool report. I mean, it was 50 pages. And that, it was complete. And actually, it was wonderful because we really did learn. The briefings that I've gotten in the Reagan White House have no details. I did get a wonderful briefing on the Reagan summit, the first one in Geneva, and it was all about atmospherics. It was a great briefing, but I had a lot of quotes and a lot of the mood. So what you get is really reflects the style, the thinking, the character of the man on top, all the way down through, even to the briefings. Now, I'm not telling you, I don't think I've really responded to your question about who is really being open, because that doesn't really necessarily reflect openness. They're all the same in openness. They tell you what they want to tell you, and they keep from you what they want to keep from you. The Reagan White House, I think, though, there have been people who have just outright lied. And I personally didn't have that in the Carter White House. Personally had it in this one, so there's a little bit of difference.
You've been with Face of the Nation now for more than 4 years. I was wondering if you have any plans for the shorter, medium, or long-term future to be doing something else with CBS.
No. I really like Face the Nation. It's when you are basically a street reporter or a White House reporter for 10 years or more, the idea of actually doing something for a half hour is delicious, and studying an issue for that, to get yourself ready for something that's going to be an in-depth interview with someone is actually fun.
Of the presidential contenders and possible presidential contenders, who do you think is the most media savvy and why? And do you think any of them have significant things to say which are being blocked by lack of such savvy?
This is about political savvy. First, let's do the Democrats, okay? First, I want to say that I do not consider them dwarfs, and I'm kind of furious at the idea that it's an unimpressive group of people. They're all pretty smart. They've all looked at the issues that we're all going to be concerned with. And of course, no one's going to be a star if they're basically unknown to the American people. And it's really been too early to saturate the evening news with campaign stories, although we've done our share of them. I read, coming up here in Manhattan, Inc., a story on John Kennedy, JFK. And it was this point in the 60 campaign. And it's a photo essay of his personal photographer. And he and Jackie are in Iowa, and nobody talks to them. And it's about 10 pictures, and they're in Jackie's sitting in one chair in a really stunning picture, and her arms are folded, and there are women around her, and they're talking to each other and totally ignoring her. There's another one of Jack Kennedy walking down Main Street and trying to get people to deal with it. And they titled it, "He Would Be a Dwarf." You know, he would have been you would have called him a dwarf too. So I really think it's unfair at this point in time to expect that anybody would be looking like a giant, given the fact that they're unknown. And which is another reason it's said over here that Biden's campaign collapsed so quickly. I don't think that is blocking. The fact they're unknown is blocking any information from getting to the public that's really that devastating. The fact that so many of the character issues have been covered is because the public hasn't been interested in issues. They've done all these debates, and really none of the things they've said have caught on. But I really do think that's going to change now. Unless, of course, the market goes back up and the pressure's off. But as long as there's an air that something's not right, that we have to fix things, that the economy isn't going in the right direction, I think that what they have to say will become more important. Now, the Republicans are different. Jeff Greenfield, who someone mentioned before, and I did something together last night. He said something really provocative. He said, why is it that everybody in the Republican, on the Republican side who should be running is running? The vice president, the minority leader who was the majority leader, a former secretary of state. I mean, their stars are out there. And yet on the Democratic side, the people that you think should be running are not running. And why is that? I mean, I don't know. It's a wonderfully provocative question. The people you would have thought a year ago would be in the race are not. And a bunch of surprises are in the race. I have no idea why it should be that way. I also think that someone will emerge on the Democratic side. He'll win the Iowa caucus, and he'll be in the cover of Time magazine, and then he'll be a giant, and it'll move on from there. But I also think that with all these debates, you're getting to hear the issues. And there's a debate every year. There's one tonight in New Orleans. And then I read about one, I guess, yesterday in the paper today. So there really are talking issues out there. I'm getting hoarse.
People say that Reagan is senile. What is the state of his mental health?
Now, you see, I don't think that's a funny question. They're laughing, but you and I know that's not a funny question, right? I don't know. Can I tell you a personal story? It's a great story. When it was my last day at the White House. It was about a year ago. First, let me first say that the questions that you might have about his state of mind have been questions about that we've had about him since the first day he was president. So, with that in mind. My last day at the White House was a year ago, and I had the obligatory final session with the president. By obligatory, I mean when a reporter from a major news organization leaves after a long time, you get to have an audience with the president. And my husband and my daughter were invited. And we went in, and the press secretary let it be known to me that it would be inappropriate to ask him anything serious. That's not what you do in your final session. You basically say goodbye and pose for pictures. I will let you know that my husband, among other things, is a screenwriter. You have to know that. So in we go. And I thought, oh my God, this is it. He really is finished. I looked at him, and he looked so old. I almost was astonished. Now, that just goes to show you how the White House correspondent whose office is as far away from the Oval Office as I am from that fireplace, I had never been that close to him. I'd never seen how old his skin was and how gray and how sagging and fragile he was. I remember right around his neck thinking, God, he's really, his hands were covered with age spots and his eyes were glazed over. And he's standing there shaking my hand like this, and his head's bobbing, and they're taking our pictures. And I'm saying, God, I'm going to run out of here and do the story of my life. I'm going to rush on the lawn and tell everybody. And he's... But you have to make small talk. So I said, well, Mr. President, this is my daughter, and this is my husband, and, you know, he writes movies. Well, this man, he doesn't, you know, life doesn't slowly come to his body. This pop! And I say, he lost 50 years. Pop! Face brightly, lots of color in his cheeks. The age spots seem to disappear. And he comes to life. And he says, Aaron, what movies have you written? And they then start talking about Hollywood. And the man talked and was wonderful and hilarious. And I finally said to him, he charmed us. He just totally did what you read he does all the time. People go in angry and come out, I don't know, just defanged, if you will. I said to him, well, Mr. President, I had been at the White House longer than he was at that point, had been. I'd been there for 8 years, and he was in his sixth year. So I said, well, 3 months from now, I'll write you a letter and tell you if there's life after 8 years at the White House. And he said, you don't have to do that, because I was governor of California for 8 years, and I know what it's like to leave. One day, after Nancy and I had moved back to our house, we were invited to a party, we got all dressed up, and we went out and got into the back seat of the car and waited for someone to drive us off. I mean, it was like that, one of those after the next. And I had said to him at some point, which is true, to bring my daughter into the conversation, I said, you know, when I was here and Carter was president, my little girl used to tell people that the president worked for her mother. And I said, but now that you're president, she tells people that I work for you. And he thought that was charming, and yada. So we leave, you know, it's over, and we leave, and my husband's saying, isn't he wonderful? I mean, a puddle on the floor. We get down the end of the corridor, and he comes out of the Oval Office. My daughter's name is Taylor. He says, Taylor, come back here. And I'll never forget it. He's tall, and she's little, and he looked down like this. And he said, Taylor, I can't let you leave here without knowing the truth. I work for your mother, too. You know, so you ask me. I don't know. I was ready to go on the lawn and say, he's finished. He can't talk. He just stands there. His eyes are glazed over. We were in there for a half hour, and he was right there. He was wonderful. He was charming. He was telling jokes, and they weren't just canned jokes. It was quick. I mean, that's sort of my sense, that he gets bored easily. He doesn't pay attention, but when he has to, like, to get ready for a news conference, he does. In this last news conference, some people said, well, it was awful. But, that's basically his news conference. He answered the questions. He didn't respond to the questions, but maybe that's intentional. So it's hard to answer your question. I think that he's probably the way he's always been, and maybe a little less. I think he's lost a lot of energy. I think Iran-Contra really hurt him spiritually, if you know what I mean. And his sense of this is fun and things are going well have been greatly diminished. And he's obviously a visceral person, and I think his heart isn't in it the way it used to be. And he probably doesn't go at it with the same verve and gusto. But up here, I mean, I don't know.